This is Professor Richard Carlson, and this is the podcast lecture for our Contracts 2 class scheduled for July 7th. I'm going to be doing this podcast probably in separate parts so that I can upload one part at a time, and that's just to avoid the difficulty of losing everything if I have a technical problem. Let me also state at the outset that my goal is to cover a considerable amount of material in this podcast. It's a way of getting us caught up. I don't have the bound book in front of me, so I can't give you exact page number of where I tend to reach, but I can tell you that this podcast lecture will attempt to cover through the case called Printing Center versus Supermind. I advise you, therefore, to try to read through that case before you start this podcast. And then for Monday, we will begin with the end of the Printing Center versus Supermind case and try to proceed approximately 25 pages from that point. That's a rough estimate. Obviously, 25 pages may fall in the middle of a case or a middle of material. And in that event, you should go to the end of whatever material you're in. I'll try to send an updated assignment by email when I return from my trip. Now, when we left off on Monday, we had introduced the subject of something called constructive conditions. This is one of the most difficult concepts I find for people to grasp, and I see it in great evidence in the final exams. People have a difficulty distinguishing the conditions that we began with, express or implied conditions that are in essence part of a bargain, the intended bargain of the parties, versus constructive conditions. You can think of express and implied conditions as something designed by the parties, whereas constructive conditions are a rule or device invented by the courts. They serve similar purposes. But one of the key differences between these two types of conditions is what we might call the standard of fulfillment. As we have previously said, an implied or express contract, or excuse me, condition that is the design of the parties, typically sets a precise threshold or ceiling, something that has to happen or the deal is off. And this means that the close doesn't count. The important exception is that the condition might be worded in a way that allows for a certain amount of play or discretion or subjectivity or bending of standards. But when we talk about constructive conditions, which are imposed by the courts as a way of ordering performance and achieving certain other policies, we have to remember that exactness is not so important. The parties didn't negotiate for exactness. And as a result, when it comes to constructive conditions, perfection will not be required. And one of the most important things that you can do to prepare for the exam is to learn to distinguish the different standards of performance that apply to express or implied conditions on the one hand versus constructive conditions on the other. Let's begin with a simple review of material we've covered. There is a review problem at the very beginning of our slides for today. Take a look at review problem number one. You can pause the podcast, and when you're ready, turn it on, and I will explain the answer. So here's the answer to review problem number one. The answer is C. That is the only correct answer in this case. Note that the parties didn't design or negotiate or draft or imply any particular set of conditions that were a limit of either party's duty. What's going to happen, though, is that the court has to come up with some way of ordering performance. The court's going to use constructive condition. As we'll find out later, constructive conditions are quite a bit more flexible than conditions that were actually negotiated by the parties. In any event, when one party's performance takes time and the other party can perform in just a moment, such as by the payment of money, the usual rule that the courts follow is that the party whose performance takes time has to go first, and that means the builder has to complete his work before he is entitled to be paid. To put this in the language of conditions, it is a condition of the owner's duty to pay that the builder should complete his own performance. Now, if you've wondered why it isn't the other way around, why shouldn't we require the owner to pay first and the builder to go second, that's worthy of a good discussion, but we're going to keep it simple and simply point out that somebody has to go first. Somebody has to be the person who goes out on the limb. The court had to choose one or the other, and historically, the courts have preferred to protect the party who pays money. He goes last, and that makes him much better protected and much more secure. If you don't like the result, and builders rarely do like this result, they negotiate a different result. Note what happens, therefore. This is a case where the rule, in effect, places the onus for negotiating and drafting on the builder. He should know from experience that he's got to come up with a payment schedule, a contractual payment schedule, that gives him better protection and that helps to finance his construction of the work. The burden is on him to demand that schedule as a condition of his work, and if he doesn't, then we fall back on the constructive condition, which is outlined in the answer to review problem number one. We also saw that in Stewart versus Newberry, our previous case. Let's advance now to the next slide, review problem number two. You can place this on hold and then turn it back on when you have the answer. Here's the answer to problem number two. The answer is A. Now, there are actually a couple of different ways that we might answer this problem. A is one of them. B, C, and D are simply wrong. It's a good thing to remember, by the way, about multiple choice questions. You should first strike out the problems or the selections that are completely wrong. What you might be left with are one or two questions that are right, but they aren't completely right. Don't worry about completely right. Go with what's right, especially after you've negated what has to be wrong. Now let me explain why A is right, but perhaps incomplete. It is one way of dealing with this problem by saying that what we have here is a constructive condition, particularly if the parties haven't been otherwise clear about what they intended. Here the parties arguably just scheduled the time for payment by the owner, and they timed it according to particular stages of construction. This is natural because you can't really predict the exact day or date on which construction will reach a certain stage. So instead, you schedule payment by the completion of different stages. Now, some parties go farther than that. Not only do they schedule the payment in periodic payments, just like this, and this certainly better protects the builder, they will make perfect performance the condition of the owner's next payment. They'll be very explicit about this. It will be, in fact, a condition, and it will be enforced, for example, by a requirement of inspection, and everything at the previous stage has got to be done perfectly. It has to be complete before the builder is entitled to any part of that next payment. Now, there is a drawback to that approach, because if you require perfection at every stage, what you risk is that the contract will be exposed to a lot of instability. It can break down very quickly because we can have a dispute about what perfect requires. We can have a dispute about what really needs to be done to fulfill the contract. We can have a dispute about whether everything has to be corrected before we get the next payment, or whether we can continue to correct a prior defect while we move forward to the next stage of the contract. And that's why parties might not want to rely on express conditions. They'd simply rely on the constructive condition, which is a bit more flexible. Suppose, therefore, that the parties have not made each payment conditioned on complete performance of the earlier stage by the builder. We could still say, however, that each stage of work is the constructive condition of the next partial payment by the owner. In fact, the restatement, as you will have seen, follows this approach. We can have ordered pairs of performance. And within each ordered pair, the first performance due becomes the condition of the paired performance, that is the paired payment, for example. And the restatement also puts it like this. When you have performance in stages by both sides in a situation like this, there is a constructive condition that any further performance of any further payment or any further work by you is suspended as soon as there is a material breach by the other party. So that's the constructive condition in ordered pairs of work. Each completion of a phase of the work satisfies the condition of my duty to pay, but as soon as I see a material breach on the other side, that suspends or terminates my further duty to pay under the contract. I think that's probably easy enough to grasp, but don't worry if it's not. We will be seeing several examples of this in the materials to follow. So let's proceed now to the next slide, Stewart versus Newberry. Work is a condition of payment. We actually looked at this slide before, I believe, at the end of our last class. I think it makes a little bit more sense now in having looked at the previous review problems. Finished work taking time is the condition of the duty to pay, and this protects the buyer from theft of his money, but it certainly does expose the builder to the risk that the buyer will steal his services. By the way, if you follow the news, perhaps you're aware that one of the most significant types of theft going on in our economy right now is theft of services. This is a real problem. It typically occurs especially with illegal aliens who have a difficult time enforcing their contractual right to pay. The employer engages the worker to perform perhaps a week of service with the idea that once that week of service is complete, then the worker is entitled to pay. And of course, that's the ordinary way of arranging things. Work goes before pay. But some dishonest buyers of services, employers in this case, take advantage of providers of services by taking advantage of their service and then refusing to pay. So what's the solution? The provider of work needs to draft a schedule of paired units of work and pay. He's still somewhat exposed to risk because he always has to go first, but this reduces the amount of his risk. Now, when we have paired units of work, that means that a unit of work is the condition of the next unit of pay, which in turn is the condition of the next unit of work. The parties might write that explicitly into their contract, which would make it express condition with the usual requirement of perfection or near perfection. If they haven't been that explicit about the requirement of conditions, then a court will find that these are constructive conditions. But again, constructive conditions are much more lenient than express or implicit conditions. Let's go to the next slide. A restatement rule restates our new rule. Section 237 says it is a condition of each party's remaining duties to render performance that there be no uncured material failure by the other party to render such performance due at an earlier time. Now, I emphasized a couple of words there that I want you to focus on. One is the idea of cured versus uncured, and the other is material. It's going to be a major part of our attention for the next class or so to discuss what we mean by a material failure and what the significance is of the possibility that the breach can still be cured. Note that this is a very different statement than what we would have for express conditions. Express conditions fail and it's all over. And express conditions either fail or they don't fail. We don't ordinarily get into the question of whether it was a material failure or something else. Next slide, simultaneous exchange, the requirement of tender. What happens in those situations where both parties can perform at the same time? And usually this means that each party can perform in an instant. The classic example of this would either be a sale of goods or a sale of land. I can deliver fish to you, and you can instantly pay me in grain or in money. I can deliver land to you in the form of a deed, and you can instantly pay me back in money. Both parts of the exchange can be performed in an instant. Now, you might ask, doesn't someone still have to go first? And the answer of the common law, which is adopted by the restatement goes like this. What we've done is we've invented the concept of tender because we have a problem here. We can imagine people showing up at the same street corner ready to perform their exchange, and it's like two gunmen waiting for the other to draw first. Could you get into a situation where both parties are refusing to deliver until the other party places the goods or the money in their hand first? Well, here's what we say under the rule of tender. It is a constructive condition of each party's duty to perform that the other party has made a so-called tender of performance. Now, tender of performance is something just short of actual performance. Tender means a present willingness and ability to perform. So if you show up with your fish and you're ready, willing, and able to deliver that fish, and the other party shows up and he's ready, willing, and able to deliver the grain, you have now both made a tender. And each of you has triggered, each of you has satisfied the condition of the other party's duty to perform. That is, we've satisfied constructive conditions in this case. Now, here's the other important thing. In general, if you're going to sue the other party for failing to perform, you're going to have to show that you did, in fact, tender your performance or that you were excused from doing so before you sued, because until you've made a tender, you haven't yet satisfied the condition of the other party's duty. You can't say they've breached a duty unless their duty has come due, and their duty has not come due until you've tendered your performance. Next slide. Prevention, interference, or lack of cooperation. One of the ways that constructive conditions are like express or implied conditions is that they are subject to excuses. In other words, the failure of the condition might be excused so that we can go forward with the contract even though that constructive condition failed. One excuse would be non-cooperation or interference by the party who owes the dependent or conditional duty. Imagine, for example, that you have hired a plumber to fix the pipes in your house. The constructive conditions for this contract will be that the plumber has to finish his work, and his completing the work will be the condition, the constructive condition of your duty to pay. But let's suppose the plumber shows up at the scheduled time and you bar him from the door. You won't let him in. By doing so, of course, you interfere with his performance. Well, the plumber can't possibly fulfill the constructive condition of your duty to pay unless he can get into the house. And if we followed the usual rule, this would place him in an impossible situation. He wouldn't be able to sue you for his the lost profit, the damages that he may have suffered, because he hasn't triggered your duty to perform yet. He hasn't made your duty to pay come due yet. So what do? If you have interfered with his performance, we say that your non-cooperation or interference excuses the failure of the constructive condition of your duty to pay. And that means that he can immediately sue you for his lost profit, the amount of money he expected to earn, even though he hasn't yet completed his own performance. He hasn't fulfilled the express condition. He hasn't fulfilled the express condition, but then that express condition has been excused. Now, there was an issue about that in the Stewart case. It might yet become an issue on remand when the case is tried again, because the builder will argue that the owner, the developer, did certain things to interfere with his ability to perform his work, and that this excused his inability to fulfill the constructive condition of the owner's duty to pay. Next slide, anticipatory breach by repudiation. The slide there, the picture on that slide, is a scene from Casablanca when Ilsa leaves her Dear John letter to Rick repudiating their relationship. Let's advance to the next slide, Hoekstra versus Delatour. Question here is whether the plaintiff Hoekstra jumped the gun by suing before his employer's duty to pay had come due. Can you do that? Can you sue somebody before they've actually breached, before the time for their performance has come due? Can you say in advance, well, they haven't breached yet, but I'm sure that they will, and therefore I want to sue today. Next slide. Why is Hoekstra in such a hurry? Hoekstra had a fixed-term contract to serve Delatour as his courier. The contract start date was June 1, end date was September 1. It was going to be a sort of a summer trip through the continent of Europe. They didn't have cell phones, so they had to use people instead to deliver messages. On May 11th, which is almost 3 weeks before the contract performance was to begin, Delatour sends a letter to Hoekstra saying, "Your services are not needed. I terminate the contract." Well, of course, this is repudiating the contract, but you could say that the contract hasn't been breached yet because performance isn't due. Not only has Hoekstra's performance not yet come due, Delatour's duty to pay has not come due. But Hoekstra doesn't wait around to see if this contract will be performed or not. He files a lawsuit immediately on May 22nd. That's still more than a week before even his own performance was due, and we have to suspect that quite possibly Delatour would not have been required to pay money until perhaps later in the summer, perhaps not even until the very end of the summer. You might wonder why Hoekstra is in such a hurry. Why wouldn't he just wait until we could say, in fact, the time for payment has come due, and therefore you haven't paid, and therefore there has in fact been a breach. Why didn't he wait? Here's one theory. Delatour is still on his way to Europe, and once he crosses the channel, he will be outside the realm, which will make it impossible to serve him with personal service. He will be beyond the personal jurisdiction of any English court. So Hoekstra has wisely initiated the lawsuit on the 22nd and probably served Delatour with process before Delatour could get on the boat to take him across the channel. Delatour's defense is, you can't sue me yet because, number one, you haven't performed the services that are the constructive condition of my duty to pay, and even if you had, I still wouldn't have been required to pay you until much later in the summer, perhaps not even until September 1. Next slide. Conditions of Delatour's duty. Remember how the constructive conditions should play out in a situation like this. Hoekstra is required to go first or next before Delatour pays. Service is the constructive condition of the duty to pay, but Hoekstra has not performed yet, and Delatour's payment, therefore, is not due yet. Thus, Delatour has not breached yet, but we might say that the alleged breach here is anticipatory. It's expected to happen. It's likely to happen even if it hasn't. Still, note that Delatour might still change his mind. He might be reasoned with, and if he did change his mind, of course, this would render the suit unnecessary. We could avoid a lot of litigation. Another problem, how can we know damages in advance? Assuming, for example, that we got quickly into court the very next day, how would Hoekstra prove the amount of his lost wages when the time for his employment has not arrived and he might yet substitute, perhaps even for a better-paying job? This, by the way, is why many courts, at least before this case, might have hesitated to allow the suit to be brought so early. Next slide. Repudiation excuses condition. Remember that we're talking about things that excuse the failure of a condition. In essence, in this case, by excusing the condition, we have accelerated the arrival of the duty to pay. It becomes due immediately. We can think of repudiation as analogous to prevention. You deter Hoekstra from working when you tell him in advance you're not going to pay him. This excuses the constructive condition of Delatour's duty to pay. What's more, Hoekstra need not even tender his performance. Understand that Delatour's argument was that at the very least Hoekstra needed to wait around until June 1st and remain ready, willing, and able to perform just in case Delatour changed his mind, but that would be very inefficient because given that Delatour has already said he's not going to pay, the wisest thing for Hoekstra to do is to go ahead and find work with somebody else. But if he finds work with somebody else, he won't be ready, willing, and able to serve de la Tour. So we free him of that responsibility to remain ready, willing, and able, and we say he can go ahead and substitute, and he can go ahead and mitigate his damages then, and he can also immediately sue. Obviously, in some cases, this will mean that we will have to predict damages. Now, we know in the real world, this case is not going to go to trial earlier than September 1, unless justice is just a lot faster in medieval England, and I don't think that it was. The reality is that the case isn't going to go to trial for many, many months, and by then we'll know what the damages are. But in any event, to the extent that we have to forecast damages, we've already seen that judges frequently will. They will assume this very difficult task if they have to. Next slide. Suing for breach in advance, calculating the damages. This slide is really a review of things that you already know, and it's to pull it forward and to connect it with what we're learning right now. We've learned a number of things about the calculation of damages. First of all, remember that the value of an unperformed promise is normally determined as of the date scheduled under the contract. Well, in the Hoekstra case, that would be somewhere between June 1 and September 1. However, remember that we learned in the Cosden Oil versus Octian Gesellschaft case that the value of the promise, in a code case at least, is determined as of the date the injured party learned of the breach, and in fact a similar rule is followed even in cases outside the code. Thus the question becomes, when did Hoekstra learn of the breach? And that relates to another important question: when could he begin to mitigate damages by engaging in a substitute transaction? Well, fortunately for Hoekstra, in a case like this, it's very unlikely that the value of his services is fluctuating wildly as commodities do in a very exciting market. The market for a courier's services might get exciting under certain circumstances, but probably a month here and a month there isn't going to make much difference. So in this case, it probably doesn't make much difference, but we can imagine that in others it might. The difficulty is that for someone like Hoekstra, the injured party, you never really know completely for sure what you should do. Should you wait a little while and try to persuade de la Tour to change his mind? Should you shop for a substitute very slowly or very quickly? Do you jump at the first substitute that comes along, or do you wait and hope for something better? And the law tends to be very forgiving of the injured party in this scenario. And so what we say is that Hoekstra can take his time, but eventually he will have to make an election. He will have to make a decision when it becomes unreasonable for him to wait any longer. Initially, he can elect to allow de la Tour a chance to revoke, or he can, if it's reasonable to do so, and in most cases it will be after a repudiation, he can simply decide to treat this as an immediate breach. He can substitute immediately, and if he wants, he can sue immediately. We'll say quite a bit more about these choices later on when we talk about the problem of election and revocation of repudiation. For now, let's advance to the next slide, which is Canavis versus Hancock Bank and Trust. The picture here is to remind us that we should never assume that anyone is too small or too poor to tackle the job, because sometimes it's the minnow that swallows the whale. The principal purpose of this case is to deal with the question whether the injured party has to prove that he would in fact have been able to perform if not for the breaching party's earlier repudiation. Let's go ahead to the next slide now. Did the bank, in fact, repudiate? The contract in this case gave Canavis a first right of refusal to buy particular property. That means that the bank can accept offers from other people, and whenever that happens, Canavis will have the opportunity to match the offer, and if he does, he gets the property, or he can decline if he doesn't want to match that that offer. Anyway, the bank is going to deny him his right of first refusal. Remember also that if everything works as planned, Canavis will be required to tender his payment for the price of the property as a constructive condition of the bank's duty to tender the property. To make a long story short, here Canavis has sued, even though he never offered up the money. He never tendered the money. He didn't have it in hand, either in cash or as a check. He never held that out to the bank and showed them that he was ready to buy. Nevertheless, he's suing. He's suing without having tendered. Now, can you do that? The question depends on whether the constructive condition of the bank's duty to deliver the property was excused. Was his tender excused? One way that we can excuse his failure to tender is because there has been a repudiation by the other party. That's what we learned in the Hoekstra versus De La Tour case. The other party's repudiation excuses your failure to tender your own performance and allows you to sue even without having performed. But this case is a little bit different from Hoekstra versus De La Tour in the sense that the bank never said, we will not accept your purchase. We will breach the contract. We are canceling the contract. They never said anything like that. Instead, what they did was they simply sold the property to a third party. In essence, they made it impossible for themselves to perform. Now, here's what we learn in this case, number one, of a couple of things. The bank's act making its own performance impossible equals a repudiation. If you do something that makes it impossible for you to perform, that's the equivalent of telling the other party that you repudiate the contract. Next slide. Inability to tender is a defense. What we've just concluded is that Canavis was allowed to sue, even though he hadn't tendered payment, because the bank had effectively repudiated by making it impossible for the bank to deliver the property. But the bank has another defense here. Their defense is that, in essence, it goes as follows. We did effectively repudiate the contract, but you haven't really been hurt because we think that you could not have performed anyway. You don't have the money, and we don't think that you could ever have afforded paying for this property. And maybe that's the reason they just ignored him when they sold the property to someone else. Perhaps they got a little bit nervous when they noticed that his particular checking account at the bank had fallen below a certain level. Maybe he's even been bouncing checks, and they are going to assume now, well, that must mean he has no money. When we think about this, we understand another function, by the way, of the requirement of tender. It's a way of proving actual ability to perform. When you are required to tender the money to show me the money, you're showing that you really can perform, you can really pay for it before I have to deliver the deed. But what if tender has been excused because of the seller's repudiation? If that happens, the buyer won't be tested. He will not have been put on the spot of actually coming up with the money. So in this case, the court does allow the repudiator the following defense. You, the bank, the seller, can try to show that the injured party, that is the buyer, was not really able to perform, so he hasn't been hurt. The third thing that the court concludes in this case is that Canavis bore the burden of actually proving his ability to pay the price. So all the bank has to do is to assert the defense, and then the burden shifts to Canavis to present evidence showing that he had the money. And most likely he is going to be able to satisfy that burden because he's just going to borrow the money, presumably from another bank. He doesn't want to borrow the money from Hancock after this. Next slide refers to Restatement Section 254, an obligee's inability excuses the obligor's repudiation. And I'll let you read through that on your own. I've tried to call your attention to the fact that when you try to predict that someone would have been unable to perform, there are a couple of ways of doing that. Number one, you actually prove inability. Number two, you might try to prove they had some motivation to breach the contract. Motivation is always speculative. The best way to establish this defense is if you can come up with evidence of actual inability to perform so that they would, in fact, have breached. Next case, and next slide, McCloskey versus Minwell Steel Company, takes us back to an important event in the 1950s when President Truman nationalized the steel industry. He did this because the U.S. was engaged in war in the Koreas, and there was a major labor strike. The strike threatened to shut down steel production and interfere with the war effort, so President Truman nationalized the steel mills and took control of the production of steel. He also then assigned steel production to satisfy our defense needs. Next slide. McCloskey versus Minwell Steel, difficulty is not repudiation. We've been talking about what is repudiation. Repudiation is a statement that you will not perform. Repudiation is an action that makes it impossible for you to perform. What happens if you do something just short of that? For example, in this case, Minwell wrote the following letter. At the present writing, we cannot give you a positive promise as to our ability. They can't because President Truman has made it exceedingly difficult to find steel anywhere. Now, admitting your difficulty and perhaps even the likelihood that you won't be able to perform is not the same as saying you definitely will not perform or making it impossible by your own action. So Minwell didn't repudiate, and Minwell didn't do anything by its own action that made it unable to perform. Was it, in fact, not possible for Minwell to perform? Well, we've already learned that if McCloskey can prove that Minwell never would have been able to perform, this might be a defense for their own breach. But there are some interesting facts in this case, and to keep it short for this podcast, it turns out that there were things McCloskey could have done to use its connections to free up a supply of steel so that Minwell could have performed the contract. And so that raises the possibility of lack of cooperation and even interference by McCloskey. Next slide. Here's the restatement view again of anticipatory breach and the difference between what we've had in Hoekster or Canavis versus what we didn't have in the McCloskey case. A repudiation is either a statement by the obligor to the obligee indicating that the obligor will commit a breach that would of itself be a total breach, or B, a voluntary affirmative act which renders the obligor unable or apparently unable to perform without such breach. Neither of those things happened in the McCloskey case. Here are some review problems now on the very next slide. Take a moment to read number one, place this on pause, and turn it back on when you're ready to talk about the answer. Number one should be easy at this point. Delatour, in this case, hasn't said that he's going to repudiate the contract, nor has he done anything that makes it impossible for him to perform. Buying a puff phone doesn't make it impossible for him to pay another employee. So Hoekster could not prove anticipatory breach. He would be required to remain ready, willing, and able to work. He might actually be required to work, and he would not be allowed to sue until he could prove that he had satisfied the condition for Delatour's duty to pay. Take a look now at problem number two. Place this on pause and turn it back on when you're ready to answer. Well, this question typically elicits a pretty interesting discussion, and there are plenty of interesting things that we could say about it. We could also refer to lots of solutions outside contract law in employment law, but let's keep it simple. Hoekster hasn't said that she will not perform, so she hasn't repudiated. Has Hoekster committed a voluntary act that renders it impossible or makes her unable to perform? This is where we get into the discussion is getting pregnant, a voluntary act. And secondly, does it really render you unable to perform as a courier? I can tell you that many years ago I was involved in litigation involving flight attendants who were typically grounded as soon as they became pregnant, and the question was whether being pregnant made you unable to serve as a flight attendant. To make a long story short, I'll tell you that the flight attendants won that case more often than they lost. Let's go on to the next slide. Another thought about McCloskey and Minweld, other arguments for Minweld. I referred earlier to the possibility that McCloskey violated an implied duty to cooperate by failing to loosen or grease the wheels a little bit of the bureaucracy to help Minweld get its supply of steel. If there were an argument about whether McCloskey had a duty to be more helpful, some of the factors that would possibly be important was the fact that the parties didn't really account for this in the draft of their agreement because it was somewhat unforeseeable. They can be excused for not having said explicitly that McCloskey would facilitate the supply of steel. It doesn't look like it would have imposed much burden on McCloskey because all they would have to do is to call the War Department and say, look, this steel is for the construction of a hospital where a lot of your soldiers will be spending the next few months after their active duty. And finally, the importance of the cooperation greatly outweighs the burden to McCloskey. Another angle of the McCloskey case that you might think about if you had a problem like this on the exam is the possibility that Minweld would be excused from its liability in this case if it could prove that the president's actions were a supervening event that rendered Minwell's performance either impossible or impracticable. Next slide. Reflections on McCloskey. Trouble on the horizon. I kind of like the outcome in McCloskey. I think it's the right result. On the other hand, this case raises some real problems that we still have to deal with in the law. We've raised the standard pretty high for proving that a party has engaged in anticipatory breach, but there are a lot of times when the writing's on the wall, you can tell the other party's going to breach. There's just no way that they're not going to breach. The trouble is they haven't said that, and they haven't done anything by their own hand that makes it impossible for them to perform. Well, this could put you in a very difficult situation. Do you risk continuing to deliver goods or money to such an unreliable party? Do you expose yourself to the risk of missed opportunities by failing to initiate a substitute transaction? There is a solution to this problem that we'll be seeing momentarily. We're going to talk about something called a demand for assurance, where you require, in essence, a little bit of proof that the other party really will perform, and we'll have quite a bit to say about that in a few slides. But for now, let's advance to the next slide. We got there faster than I could have remembered. Demanding assurance. If you have a good reason to believe that they might breach, here is what you might do to secure yourself. Here's what I'm going to do, however. I'm going to split this lecture in half. I'm going to go ahead and try to post this part of the podcast on the website. This will become Volume 1, and it will be followed by Volume 2, which will begin with this very slide.